Спасибо большое. Пожалуйста.
Добрый день.
Вы знаете, я...
Пожалуйста, начнем.
Вы знаете, у нас все-таки... Люди-то, конечно...
Очень многим недовольны на сегодняшний день.
Сейчас. Ну, дайте мне завершить.
Ну, ребят, давайте потише.
Давайте не кричать.
Ну, странно, согласитесь? Ну, честно,
что...
Pithy one-liners and salty language? Check. Fawning questions from the state media? Check. Evasive answers and inaccurate claims? Check and check. In his marathon annual press conference, Vladimir Putin suggested doping whistleblower Grigory Rachednikov had been drugged by the FBI. He questioned the mental state of some U.S. officials, and he likened opposition leader Alexei Navalny to former Georgian president Mikhail Saakashvili. But he also delivered a mild, albeit clear, rebuke to Rosneft CEO Igor Sechin, a longtime crony. Putin launched his presidential campaign in earnest this week by answering, or not answering, the media's questions for nearly 4 hours. So, what do we learn? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio is veteran journalist and Kremlin watcher Kirill Husuhotsky, executive editor of RFURL's Russian language television program Current Time. Welcome back to the podcast, Kirill.
Hello, Brian.
Good to have you. So, a few things jumped out at me from Putin's annual ritual. Very early on, of course, Putin made it clear he was running for president as an independent, suggesting he was distancing himself from the ruling United Russia Party and was planning on running a populist campaign, or at least that's how I interpreted that particular announcement. Second, the vast majority of the questions focused on domestic politics, the economy, and social issues. When they did focus on foreign affairs, Putin seemed to fall back on old, well-worn talking points. And finally, Putin appeared to take a slap at Igor Sechin, suggesting he could have testified in the former economics minister Alexei Ulyukayev's corruption trial, which, of course, wrapped up today and we'll be discussing in the second half. What were your key takeaways from yesterday's press conference?
It was, Brian, I think it was kind of one of the most boring press conferences that Vladimir Putin has ever gave. There were not too many takeaways because he didn't say too much new. It was almost like he was bored. It was so uneventful. It was so low key. It's the same sort of uneventful and low key that he wants his presidential campaign to be.
That's exactly where I wanted to go, because that was my thinking exactly. The Kremlin seems to want to have this presidential election almost be something nobody notices.
Like a non-event.
And there was all this talk beforehand of like wanting to spruce it up by bringing Ksenia Sobchak in, by building up turnout among the youth. There was a piece in the media today about how people at the local level have been encouraged to have kind of parties and celebrations on the day of the election to boost turnout. And another thing that jumped out at me was this is the 13th time Putin has done this. This act can't help but get old in these things.
And he looked old, and he looked almost sometimes even his attention was off. He sometimes didn't quite understand what the question was, and then he was coming back to the question somebody asked 5 minutes prior to that. And then even when tough questions were asked, especially I would note not the one by Sobchak, but the one by a Russian journalist Tatiana Felgengauer,
who was
attacked at knife point at her workplace at Echo Moskvy just a few weeks before. She asked the fantastic questions about Navalny, about Nemtsov, about all the other people, and Putin did not even answer that. Yeah. The only name he kind of grasped upon was Igor Sechin, and that's the only thing that he answered. Yeah. Sobchak's question he didn't answer. Other questions he didn't answer. It was a spectacle for domestic audience, for the domestic audience. It was not for international audience, and that's why it didn't even play much in the foreign media yesterday. But for domestic audience, and that's why, you know, he was in control. The whole message is, I'm in control, nothing for you to worry about. I'm in total grasp of all the facts and figures and regulations and whatever laws number 349. You have nothing to worry about. Everything is set. Go and enjoy your New Year's Eve.
Yeah, No, I tend to agree with that. That was the message he was trying to send to the public. He didn't seem to be sending any message to the world in this one. And usually when I look at these press conferences, I'm looking, what was the Kremlin's message to the public? And you just nailed it right there. What was the message to the elite? And I want to get into that a little bit, actually. And what was the message to the West and the world? There wasn't much of a message to the West and the world.
Because he doesn't care. He doesn't care about the West and the world too much. Until February, when the United States will discuss sanctions, but that will be, you know, the next step, and this is not the forum to talk about that. You know, his press conference, so he thought this is not for that. You know, one message he kept sending several times is that Trump is a friend.
Yes. Spoke by phone after.
Yeah, he was trying to relay that message out, and that's the only. There was a question about North Korea; it was uneventful. There was a question about foreign agents; same thing. There was a question about other things. He didn't
about Ukraine. He, and again, he fell back on this distorted view of Ukrainian history that he always.
Yeah, and with quite a lot of factual mistakes. And Ukraine was the only one. I think there were two moments that touched his nerve. One was Ukraine, and another is Navalny.
Everything whose name else, he still won't say.
And actually today, his spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, actually said, we don't mention him by name. That's true because we don't like the way he behaves.
So they actually were forced to address that.
Yeah, so they actually confirmed that they stubbornly do not mention him by name. He actually gave Navalny a name yesterday, and his name is Saakashvili.
Right.
He compared him to Saakashvili, and this is also very interesting because it's now very clear that Saakashvili pretty much stepped on Putin's toes, and Putin is really, really angry with him. Whatever role he's playing, wherever he's leading his political life, for some reason there is some bad blood.
There's long been bad blood. I want to zero in on that subcheck question because that was an interesting question. The question essentially was, why are you afraid of honest competition? Why won't you let Navalny into the campaign? Now, this is Ksenia Sobchak, who is running in this election with apparently clearly the Kremlin's approval. But she appears to also be trying to play her own game as well. And in sometimes I think her campaign's kind of clever doing this, being a stand-in for the old Protiv Siech against all line that used to be on the ballot. But anyway, her question was about, essentially, are you afraid of competition? Why won't you let Navalny into the campaign? And Putin's answer was that, effectively, we don't want to become a second Ukraine.
Yeah.
That was, and I, as I noted on the Daily Vertical today, he's got caught telling the truth here a lot. Because he basically says, I don't want a second Ukraine because we don't want to have a coup like they had in Ukraine. Well, that's Putin's fantasy interpretation of Ukraine. Let's look at the real history of Ukraine since independence. Sure, the country's had its problems. I think even your most ardent Ukraine supporter would say that. But let's look at elections in Ukraine. There have been five since independence. Every single one has been competitive.
Yeah, and it has been fair.
It has been free and fair.
And the power changed hands.
All but one case, Leonid Kuchma's re-election in 1999, the incumbent or the incumbent's handpicked successor lost, which doesn't bode well for Petro Poroshenko in the next election, quite frankly. But Ukraine has competitive elections. And when Putin says, I don't want another Ukraine because I don't want to have a coup by fascists or banderovci, what he really means is that I don't want competitive elections. I mean, I saw this is a strange place, a situation where Putin got caught telling the truth.
Yeah, but that's also the one moment where he really kind of lost this mask of boredom that he wore. Yeah. For hours. His answer, because we were doing a live broadcast on Current Time TV channel, and so I timed how long the answer was. Uh-huh. The answer to that question was 15 minutes long. So he spoke and he made, you know, like 10 or 11 points. He was clearly agitated, and this is what, he doesn't care about anything else. He cares about political opposition, so Navalny and so on. That's where he was very emotional. And second, for some reason, he has all the miniature details of Alexei Lukayev's case.
Right.
So those were two topics that he was really passionate about. And everything else seemed like he was just biding his time.
I mean, I also get the sense because I did, that's great that you timed that, because it did seem like a long answer and he was rambling. I mean, it was, he went on the whole thing about a second Ukraine. He went talking about Navalny, how the opposition's plotting a coup. We don't want to have any Maidans in Russia. He's really agitated by the Navalny phenomenon, isn't he?
Yeah, because this is a challenge to his power, because all the opposition in Russia has so far been so-called pocket opposition. Opposition parties, they leave off some money that they get from the budget or from the presidential administration. All the others can be controlled. Ksenia Sobchak, some say she's his goddaughter. You know, all those things. And Sobchak refuses to criticize Putin. She refuses to say, oh, he should be on trial. She's actually, it was very telling in her long question. She was saying, oh, she was pretty much equaling herself to Navalny, and that's exactly what the presidential administration wants her to do, but this is not true. She says, oh, I don't have access to, we, like Navalny and I, don't have access to the media. However, Sobchak is now a permanent fixture, pretty much a daily fixture, nightly fixture on Russian state television. She's given free rein to now to talk on state television, something that Navalny will not do. She's now, have you...
She says Navalny's name on television, which Navalny has thanked her for.
She does. But otherwise, she won't, you know, play that, you know, role. Have you noticed how she made her hand to a complete copy of a plate that Yulia Tymoshenko wore for years. So she will now be trying to play that role of Ukraine's Tymoshenko, but Ukraine's Tymoshenko played in a really competitive and a fair system, whereas here she plays the role that she probably is assigned to play quite cleverly by the Kremlin. And yesterday during the press conference, Putin's answer was pretty much belittling Sobchak. He refused to answer. He asked her, how did you come here? Are you a journalist or what?
Well, she technically still is a journalist with Deutsche TV. I'm sure that's how she got accredited.
Yeah, right? obviously. But,
and I'm sure that Peskov knew she was going to be there, allowed her in, and she got
absolutely,
a question
because it's a very cleverly staged affair. You know, the whole press conference, there can't be unexpected questions. But the interesting thing is that's touched the nerve of Putin. That's something that he really is obsessed about. He was talking about those color revolutions since Ukraine, since Georgia, and then Maidan happened. He's clearly afraid that this is something that can happen in Russia. And that can happen only with the participation of the forces he can't control. So he wants to control everything and get rid of the forces that he can't control.
I've heard from Western officials that it's even beyond like the Orange and Rose Revolution. He obsessively watches, according to Western officials I've talked to, he obsessively watches videos of Saddam Hussein being hanged in the death of
Muammar Gaddafi as well.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, so I mean, what's interesting here also, the Sobchak case illustrated this, and the question from the correspondent from ABC News who asked about collusion with the Trump campaign in the U.S. Now, that question, of course, they let that question through because you would assume the Kremlin wants to send a message on it, just like they let Sobchak's question through because they assume they want to send a message on it. But then when it came time to give that message, it was so rambling and incoherent. I mean, the answer on the collusion with the Trump campaign was rambling and incoherent.
But many, many of his answers were rambling and incoherent. It's almost like he didn't prepare, though we know that he probably did prepare for the press conference. But many of his questions, sometimes he lost his train of thought. He just couldn't understand what the question was. So it is really interesting. But, you know, he was just saying, oh, there was no collusion, and the Russian ambassador had a right to talk to whomever.
And this was all invented by Trump's political opponents.
It was all invented. And so it was nothing that we didn't know.
Yeah, no. And this was the case on all of these answers. He repeated old, tired talking points. The other interesting thing, and you mentioned Tatiana Felgengauer's excellent question. And her question was about the dual system of criminal justice that exists in Russia. right? Which I thought is probably one of the most relevant questions a journalist can ask.
Yeah, absolutely. And she listed all the names and all the instances how
Nemtsov,
how's the main suspect in the Nemtsov's killing, is at large because prosecutors just knocked on his door and didn't get any reply, or others. And even she was attacked by at a knife point. It's something that the authorities refused to recognize as a as attack against, you know, as a terrorist attack or something. So it's really interesting that she listed all those instances, and Putin didn't reply.
Well, he zeroed in on, of course, the Ulyukayev case in Sechen. We're going to discuss this at length in the second half, but I wanted to touch on it now because I thought what Putin said was kind of telling. And in light of the verdict today, we'll get into the details of that in the second half. But Putin said, well, you know, Sechen could have gone and testified in the court. You know, for those of you who are not familiar with this, Igor Sechen was called as a witness four times, if I'm not mistaken, if not five.
Yeah, probably four.
Four or five times and just simply refused to appear in court.
And then court did not summon him.
The court did not summon him.
And it's all, you know, and it just even, you know, we will talk about the verdict, but almost like in the verdict, the judge almost ruled like they didn't need him. It was all kind of clear, even without him. But to me, you know, I know we talked yesterday, Brian, and you thought that this could be, you know,
a signal. TASS picked it up immediately.
Yeah,
TASS picked it up immediately.
But it's interesting to me. It was like a slap in the wrist.
Mm-hmm.
It was Sechen and Putin are two long-standing partners. Sechen is extremely powerful. And an extremely uncanny and extremely smart. You know, I remember I spoke to him for an hour years ago, and that was one of the most interesting conversations I ever had with Russian officials in my life. He's extremely smart, and he knows how to play the game and how to play people. With Putin, I think he was just reprimanded him in about a jokey way.
Uh-huh.
And the verdict today just confirmed that.
The verdict today, which we'll discuss at length, will confirm that. Building on the Felgengauer's question, I mean, what was the message to the elite? The message to the public was clear. Stick with me. I'm steady. I'm calm. Even though he didn't look terribly steady. And if you listen to the clip we played at the very beginning, there was a lot of
We actually counted how many times he coughed in 4 hours. 177. So he was coughing pretty much.
We should all send some cough medicine.
You know, it's like pretty much one cough a minute.
Yeah.
I don't think there was a very clear-cut message for the elite. It's almost like for the elite to double guess what the message was.
Right.
The Ulyukayev's case is a signal to the elite, but with Putin, he was
don't mess with Sechen.
But that was, you know, everybody knows that. But I don't think he was clear. You know, to me, that was a really rambling appearance by Putin, which was probably the only, you know, big fixture of his electoral campaign. In the first words of this press conference, he said, "I will run as an individual, as an independent." And then, you know, this is pretty much his. And then he said, he doesn't have any program. He didn't outline any ideas. You know, it was all, you know, his last presidency, his current presidency, which is coming to an end, is a presidency of the Ukraine war. So he comes to the election.
And the revival of so-called traditional values.
Yes. Yeah, so he's going to run on that platform. He's the president of the Ukraine war. And even the presidential election, which has today been officially announced,
date of the Crimea annexation.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is just to reinforce the message. This is his idea. But what's next?
Well, this is because one of the things I was looking for yesterday, and I didn't get it, was what is the message to the elite? I didn't get a message to the West. I got the message to the public. We've gone through that. But the message to the elite is actually very, very important, because the feeling is that this is Putin's last term.
Yeah.
And that in the coming years, but particularly as we get around the time of the next Duma election, there's going to be, as Gleb Pavlovsky describes it, as a negotiation among the elite about what
the exit strategy.
The exit strategy is Putin going to be some kind of supreme leader? Is he going to switch to a parliamentary system? How is the distribution of assets and power going to look in that configuration? And I'm expecting to start to see at least some signals to the elite along this lines.
I think Putin is a bit like his friend Sechin. His strategy is divide and conquer. He's never been a czar. He has been a chairman of the board. And he always tried to balance different interests of different parts of that board of directors. And he liked to play them against each other, and that gave him that role of supreme arbiter. And that's how he constantly, played, different Kremlin towers. And I think he won't want to relinquish that role, because as soon as he anoints a successor, as soon as he gives a signal which Kremlin tower he prefers most, that will be the end of him, because they can live without him in that. So I think the only way forward for him is even more infighting in the Kremlin, is even more. So we may expect that actually the next presidency will be more strict and more grim than the one we're having.
So you
now
don't expect some kind of negotiation about the future to start? Because this is where Pavlovsky is convinced.
Right now, obviously we're all waiting who's the next prime minister, when the government will change. And actually that was
no signals on that.
Yeah, exactly. That was actually the one of the questions which he just sidestepped. He said, I'm happy with the government until the election. He does not give any signal what he sees beyond that. Will Medvedev stay?
There's a growing consensus, at least if you read the Russian political press, that Medvedev is going to
stay.
That seems to be the growing consensus. It's safe.
Yeah, but Medvedev is a placeholder. He doesn't control the government. He's just a preservation of status quo, whereas there's also a growing concern in Russia among the elites that the status quo cannot last.
Yeah, no, it's growing exponentially. I mean, again, going back to Pavlovsky, he was saying that there's a divergence between Putin the man and the collective Putin, effectively, that the system wants to preserve the system, and they want to preserve it with or without Putin. Now, my question there would be, can you preserve this system without Putin? I'm not really quite sure you can, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly, because he was, the personification. He was the one who's balancing the interests. As soon as those interests are unbalanced, and then, one party or one part of the Kremlin runs away with the victory, then the whole system is upturned.
And this is what we want to get into in the second half about the whole Ulyukayev verdict. Before we do that, just moments that jumped out at you. These things are famous for their kind of funny, strange, odd, or in quotation marks, unexpected moments. We had the gentleman who was very upset about fish, for example.
Yeah.
You had the Ukrainian journalist who has asked the same question, I don't know how many
four
years,
times.
Four times running now. What jumped out at you in terms of it?
It was probably, to me, the most something that I can now recall, and I think was the highlight. It was not those odd moments. It was still, his absolutely stern, almost to the point of hysterical attack on Saakashvili and Navalny.
Yeah.
When he was talking about Saakashvili like about some, rodent that pestering him.
Mm-hmm.
There was this long monologue about fish. There were other very ridiculous questions. Also, one thing that also stood out is that almost it also shed a light not only on Putin but also the state of journalism in that country, because the level of questions and the applause and trying to boo somebody who asked difficult questions, and actually the question, it's almost many people this morning on social media in Russia, they are talking about the demise of journalism, and this just showed not actually what kind of hole did the Russian journalistic community
dig for
themselves and where they're hiding.
Well, we can only hope that there'll be some kind of catharsis and revival. The other thing that jumped out at me, of course, was the answer about the doping whistleblower Grigory Rodchenkov.
Yes.
he suggested he was drugged by the FBI. I mean, you one of the things you look for in these things is, you know, the Putin zingers. You know, when he back when the conflict with Turkey was going on, he said that Erdogan wanted to kiss the U.S. in Vodno Mesto in one place, which was kind of an obscene gesture in the Russian language. The Rachenko thing jumped out at me with this. I mean, the doping thing seems to have gotten under his skin as well.
Yeah, obviously, because it was his pride. The Sochi Olympics was his pride, the same way as the Football Cup will be next year.
Right.
It was something that he thought will be it will cement his place in history and, you know, his legacy, because he's concerned about his legacy. And now this whole myth of the Sochi Olympics is now crumbling apart. And that's what gets him.
The Sochi Olympics and Russian sport in general.
Yeah, because sport is extremely, as we know, in all the authoritarian states, sport is playing a pivotal role, because that's something that can give the nation the pride, the sense of unity, the sense of national idea. That's something that authoritarian rulers can rely upon to unify the nation. So sport is extremely important. You know, there are so many examples of that in history. And to him now, when, you know, there is a daily attack, you know, it's the Russian winter athletes are stripped of the Sochi medals pretty much daily. One of them was stripped just, I think, yesterday or the day before. So it is shameful.
And also the ban and it's to the next Winter Olympics in South Korea.
It's very telling that they decided not to boycott, and they will send people under neutral flags, even though this harms their national sense of national pride. I think there are all sorts of not rumors but suggestions that Putin will want to use the Winter Olympics anyway in his electoral campaign.
No, I've been hearing that as well, and that'll be interesting to watch going forward. All right, well, in a few moments, we will continue our discussion and look at the conclusion of the trial of the first sitting Russian minister since the 1950s and the political message the verdict sent. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is veteran journalist and Kremlin watcher Kirill Sukhotsky, executive editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Суд приговорил признать Улюкаева Алексея Валентиновича виновным.
Алексея Улюкаева приговорили к 8 годам строгого режима.
Виновен. За Москворецкий суд столицы.
Улюкаев был арестован прямо в зале суда. На него надели оручники и поместили в клетку.
Сам Улюкаев вины не признает.
Кудрин назвал приговор ужасным.
He was the first sitting minister arrested since Leventia Beria. His corruption case is connected to a high-stakes battle over the Russian energy sector, an intrigue involving Rosneft CEO and longtime Putin crony, Igor Sechin. Today's guilty verdict, an 8-year sentence of Ulyukayev, has clear political overtones. Kirill, how do you read today's verdict? What does it signify?
I'm not surprised, first of all.
I am.
I'm not surprised. And we talked. So usually, how the Russian judicial system works is that prosecution asks for something. There is never an acquittal. In a way that even
not in a trial of this caliber,
a suspended sentence is sort of an acquittal. But this trial, where the judge repeatedly denied motions by defense, it was very clear that a prosecution gets an upper hand. Igor Sechin was not even called to testify. There was no need for that. Nothing was proved.
He was called, but he kept refusing.
Yeah, obviously. But nothing was actually proven. It was one man saying against another man saying. One of key witnesses was Sechin's head of security, Feok Tistov, who testified about bribery, but he did not even see the bribe. That was something that Sechin told him afterwards, and that was this, you know, the main argument of the defense of prosecution. And even the judge today, in one of most improbable sentences of the verdict, she said that Ulyukayev's statement contradicts, cannot be viewed favorably because it contradicts Theo Kstistov's testimony. Theo Kstistov was not even there. So, right. So the whole case is plugged with these holes, with these legal holes. We saw today the Alexei Kudrin, one of Putin's confidants and one of candidates to be the prime minister. He called the verdict terrible and groundless. That's the reaction of many other people. But this is how trials in Russia work.
Right.
Prosecution asks for punishment, and the court gives a bit less.
Right.
So the prosecution asked for 10 years. He got 8. Pretty
now,
much.
The other thing to remember, and I think the most important thing to remember, is that trials in Russia do not decide questions of law. They decide questions of politics.
And questions of power.
And questions of power. This case is tightly tied up in both. Of course, the context is that Sechin is trying to get control of as much of the energy sector as possible. This case is tied into the Bashneft privatization, which Rosneft, which Sechin heads, was trying to gain control of. Ulyukayev was allegedly standing in the way, and he allegedly, first they said he threatened Sechin, solicited a bribe, which is simply laughable. Anybody that threatens Igor Sechin should not be arrested. They should be committed. But later they dropped that charge, but that he took a bribe from Sechin. All of the leaked wiretaps suggest otherwise, but the point is it doesn't matter whether he did or not. These things are cooked up for whatever. Everybody's corrupt. Everybody's taking bribes. You don't get prosecuted unless you fall out of political favor. My question from the very beginning of this trial was this sanctioned by Putin, or does Sechin have enough juice to freelance and move the law enforcement apparatus? Because Sechin allegedly participated in a sting to set up Ulyukayev, cooperating with law enforcement. And so was this Sechin's intrigue, or was this
something Putin approved? I think it was Putin Sechin's, judging by what we hear, it is Sechin's intrigue that Putin, again, as the chairman of the board who balances and plays people against each other, balances the interests of different Kremlin towers, he decided to happen. Or he allowed it to happen. So he decided that, okay, it's interesting that Sechin now is playing two wars. So this was the first war against Ulyukayev.
Actually, because he's fighting Ulyukayev. He's fighting the rest of the technocratic wing of the elite, Igor Shuvalov, Alexei Kudrin,
Varkovich, all those people.
But he's also fighting with some very powerful businessmen who are close to the president, Gennady Timchenko, Boris and Arkady Rotenberg. So there's that element. It's not just the evil Sechin against the good technocrats here. The Timchenko and the Rotenbergs are opposing.
And also another interesting thing is Yevtushenkov. So what Sechin, kind of the second war, he is now extremely the pursuing in the courts in Russia is the battle to control Sistema, mm-hmm. Which is the parent company of Bashneft, and Sistema is Russia's largest private company, mm-hmm. Who's owned by Yevtushenkov, a very powerful and very soft-spoken oligarch. And a few weeks back, a local court in Russia ruled in favor of Sechin. Pretty much, if that ends the same way as it's going now, Sechin will have control of this Russian largest holding and company, which produces everything from oil to fertilizers to, anything. But also he will bankrupt Yevtushenkov, one of Russia's richest men. So this is, now people are asking, in the way how Putin operates is he allows somebody important to win one battle and then to lose another.
Right.
So if Sechin wins versus Ulyukayev, does that mean that he will lose against Sistema? And that will be the case to watch. Because if Sechin wins both against Ulyukayev and Sechin wins both against Sistema, so he takes control of Sistema, he bankrupts Yevtushenko, that would mean that he's really powerful.
And that's what's very interesting in this, in the context that the coming years is about a negotiation in the elite, about the distribution of the assets in the post or maybe not so post Putin period, if you will. And it wasn't just Ulyukayev, like I said, that Sechin just beat. He beat the Rotenbergs and he beat Timchenko.
Yeah.
And that's significant. I mean, I was saying this is a weird criminal case because it's one of those cases we don't know the result because Putin's two sets of close cronies of Putin were facing off against each other.
And actually, it will be interesting to see how it actually ends because just about an hour and a half ago, Russian state agency TASS issued a report quoting unnamed sources in Russia's judicial system. That's the way they put it. Where they said that Ulyukayev may not serve in jail because of his medical condition.
Uh-huh.
So in the way, so he may be convicted, but then they may not jail him, which will be obviously some sort of a, an agreement between between different parts of the Kremlin and a way to reach consensus so it does not spell out an all-out war in the Kremlin.
Yeah, no, because I think that this is where this appears to be heading. And if you look back historically at the ends of periods of rule, think back to 1999 and the end of the Yeltsin period, I expected war to break out in Tverskaya Ulitsa between the mayor's office and the Kremlin at some point. If you think to 2008, 2007, the end, what people thought was the end of the Putin period at that point, the Siloviki War was breaking out. And it seems the elite is moving along these lines. Sechin, who's kind of a lone wolf in the elite, he doesn't seem to have a lot of allies, and he seems to be alienating a lot of people, but at the same time, he seems to be accumulating a lot of power. I mean, is he trying to set himself up for life after Putin, where he'll have these assets that he can translate into power, or will this just not matter anymore when Putin's gone? Because one of the things that's coming out now is people are starting to say, you have to be powerful without Putin to be able to win in this environment.
And the question is, can you? It is very interesting to me, on another level, the whole story of Ulyukayev is a story of somebody who was in the elite, is about the elite facing the reality. It's very telling that Ulyukayev repeated time and time again during his court appearances when he was talking to journalists, his almost, you know, direct quotes were, "I didn't know that life looks like that." So he suddenly understood what it is to be on the other end, what it is to be, you know, an accused, what it is to be as somebody who takes bribes, what it is to be somebody who's stripped of everything, and thrown to jail. And he even said, "I didn't know that people live like this." So to him, it was an awakening.
Do you think that was sincere? I think it was naive.
I think it was, but Ulyukayev was this sort of... I spoke to him many times and I interviewed him many times. He's sort of a guy who was writing poems, who was reciting poems, who's kind of... He is that sort of, romantic in the Russian government. And
he's a minister.
Well,
when you're
yes,
at that level of yeah, the Russian yeah, government, but, you know how things work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Obviously, but he knew how things were there. And then suddenly he understood, you know, this was to him not only, fall from grace, it was psychological fall from grace. It was almost like he was broken psychologically, something, you know, and that was a signal to the others in the elite, you can follow that,
right.
You know. Pretty much what we were discussing today is this the second Khodorkovsky case. You know, the first Khodorkovsky case was a signal to the business, which they actually took on board,
right,
that you can be next. We remember how Potanin was afraid. We remember how others were afraid. You know, you could be next. And everybody got that signal. They moved out of politics and they followed the line.
This is a message to a minister, though.
So this is a
you can't tell a minister to get out of politics.
No. But this is a message to others in close circle near the. So that was needed to tame the business, and now he needs to tame somebody who starts inviting and planning his life after him. Don't fall out of line.
But see, the thing that the irony here is that person is Sechin. That person is Sechin. That's planning for. It appears to be planning for life after Putin.
Maybe. But it is interesting. I don't know if Putin knows what life after Putin will be. Or does he plan to step down? What does he want? And I think people are just somehow stumbling in the dark. The most popular Soviet animation film of all times is about Lonely Hedgehog going into the fog. That hedgehog doesn't see anything, and he just calls out his friend, a horse. And that's sort of what is happening now in the Kremlin, because there is a lot of fog, and they're going through the fog like that hedgehog trying to call their friends.
And nobody knows who their friends are in this
situation. And that's exactly
who, other than Ulyukayev, because this, I've always maintained this isn't about Ulyukayev. He had no power to stop the Bashnev privatization. In fact, when that alleged bribe took place, correct me if I'm wrong, the privatization had already gone through.
Yeah, it has gone through. But this is how the people on that level operates. To them, and I won't go into the details because that's may end up in some litigation. But the thing is, when you speak to some people at that level off the record, you suddenly understand how bribery is the way of life.
Right.
To them, this is a new normal, to the point where they don't think that this is bad, because everybody does that. So to him, Ulyukayev was almost like surprised that he's prosecuted for that, because everybody does that. So I think it is an attack against so-called, liberal or quasi-liberal wing, or reformist wing, somebody who can lead Russia into slightly less precarious direction.
But why Ulyukayev? Why not Shuvalov? Why not Vorkovich?
Well, Shuvalov is much higher up. Shuvalov is much more important figure. So maybe Ulyukayev is the first step.
Mm-hmm.
Dvorkovich is an easy target. And he is an enemy of Sechin. Probably Dvorkovich is not having a very easy time now as well in terms of his mind comfort. So I think, the question now other people will be asking is whether this is final stop or whether it's just the first step.
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe exactly was the aim of this whole affair, so people start worrying.
Right. Now, the other interesting thing about this trial is, as it was playing out, again, the judge called Sechin to testify four or five times. Sechin refused four or five times. That charade didn't have to happen. The trial didn't play out the way Sechin wanted it to play. He didn't want to be called to testify and have to refuse. Right. That didn't help him very much. He kind of fell from grace with that in a lot of ways. And then the leaks of the wiretaps when this so-called bribe allegedly took place. And I agree with you. It may well have taken place. But everything I listened to on those wiretaps suggested it didn't. I didn't hear any code. I mean, I know people speak in code in Russia when they're bribing somebody. I didn't hear any code. I don't know if you did. Russian's your native language.
No,
it's not mine. But I didn't hear anything that suggested anything in those tapes. Those tapes were clearly released to exonerate Ulyukayev.
Yeah.
Somebody was pushing back.
Exactly.
Who was pushing back?
He's Kremlin Tower. So again, this is some sort of a, it is not catfight because it's much more serious than a catfight, but it is some sort of, again, another scuffle within the Kremlin. Some of the scuffles that we have seen before, around the time of Boris Nemtsov's murder, around the time of, Khodorkovsky, around some other times, some scuffles in the Kremlin between different wings. So this is something that we're witnessing now, something that, one part of the elite wants, to defend Ulyukayev against Sechin because they fear of Sechin's growing influence. And Sechin wants to cement that power and to somehow monetize his position of power that he has now. Is this just the first step? That's the question.
Yeah, no. And what I see in reading the tea leaves, I kind of see three circles fighting here. Sechin on his own, basically. Then you have the so-called technocrats, Ulyukayev, Dvorkovich, Shuvalov. And then you have the Timchenko and the Rotenbergs, right? And in this case, you have Timchenko and the Rotenbergs kind of making an alliance of convenience with the so-called liberals, the technocrats, and which suggested to me if you look at that configuration, that's stronger than Sechin, but apparently not.
Apparently not. And also now, one factor to take into account is everybody is now talking about February, that when the United States may announce impose new sanctions against Russia's richest people. And everybody is now talking about who may be in that list and who may be in that potential list. That scares a lot of, among those people. And I think that factor also is a factor here, because because people understand that if they are on that list that will be published in February, mm-hmm. Their life as they know is over, because they will be connected to Putin, who will leave in some near future.
Right.
They will be connected to them forever. And the life after Putin will not be easy. So they're thinking now about that. We see how some of them, notably Oleg Deripaska, keeps an extremely low profile now, and gets some interesting coverage in newspapers that I saw in Western newspapers, because he clearly employs his PR machine. Some others, really, really step out of light. We've heard rumors how some very influential businessmen or oligarchs try to not attend any Putin's events now.
To be
as little in spotlight until February is possible. So it's very interesting how that intrigue, which is now is completely encompassing Russian elite, how it is connected to that Ulyukayev case.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. When the sanctions initially were announced after the annexation of Crimea, a lot of Russian elite were laughing at them. They're certainly not laughing anymore. Another thing I wanted to hit on was looking forward a little bit. There was recently a very good piece by Vladislav Inozentsev about what should we expect in the post-Putin era. And he said two places to look: the death of Stalin and the death of Mao. Right? And what happened in each of those cases? In each of those cases, the most powerful figure in the old regime, other than the leader, was quickly eliminated. Right. In the case of Stalin, it was, of course, Beria. And in the case of Mao, it was, of course, the Gang of Four. That does not bode well for Sechin, given the current trajectory in a post-Putin period. This has to be on his mind.
Probably, especially as everybody treats Sechin as kind of Putin's shadow cardinal, in a way, or some kind of a Putin's brain. It doesn't. But again, people also say that we've been talking about post-Putin life so many times. And there was one false start in 2008 many people thought that Putin is not coming back. And there were the same discussions we're having now. Oh, will he be the chairman of the State Council?
Yeah.
So we're now in a deja vu. We're discussing the same things we discussed 9 years
before.
But
doesn't it feel more real this time because he's older?
He's older.
It's harder to pull off a castling this time. Is he going to finally just say, to hell with it and declare himself president for life?
He may change constitution.
He could change the constitution, but he's been very reluctant to do that. On this aspect of the Constitution, he's been very reluctant to do that. I mean, I thought the most likely scenario was this kind of national leader, Russian Ayatollah, Deng Xiaoping, take your pick, which metaphor you want to use. But that's what then I thought was the most likely scenario. And that's what I think is the most likely scenario now, although it'd have to be something institutional they would have to create.
And that's why people are talking about maybe there will be a change in constitution or somehow kind of other in a shape or form. But
that just puts off the inevitable.
Putin is
mortal.
Yeah, and that's the thing, that he's not too old though. But that's why everybody was looking at any clues or hints at this press conference, and it didn't happen.
No, it didn't happen. It didn't happen, which means they haven't decided yet.
Or he
hasn't decided yet. To bring it around full circle as we prepare to wrap up, I mean, these two events, the press conference yesterday, the verdict in the Ulyukayev trial today, were almost like the two kickoff, you know, the bells for the presidential election in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and also don't forget about another piece of breaking news that came this morning. One of Russia's top banks went bankrupt.
Yes.
And it's
Promsvyazbank.
Yeah, Promsvyazbank, one of top 10 banks, which is extremely important, extremely almost like a very important piece of a puzzle in the banking sector. And it comes on the day of the Ulyukayev's verdict, who's a former central banker as well. Everybody is now afraid, does that spell a banking crisis in Russia?
Well, they've been talking about a liquidity crisis for almost a year now.
Yeah, and it's very interesting that in August, one of analysts at Alpha Capital Investment Bank, which is an arm of Petr Avin's empire. Right. He short a very innocent analytical report, as analysts do, where he said that four of top 15 banks are under threat. And he was slapped not in the wrist. He was pretty much, you know, took a push in the face. Uh-huh. Petr Avin made a personal apology. It said, no, it was an initiative of this rogue analyst, and they apologized. You know, fast forward from August to December, out of four banks that the analysts mentioned in that note, Only one remains standing.
No, there is. Economists are saying, I'm no economist, but I trust what the economists are saying. They're saying there's a looming liquidity crisis. So it's like, it's almost like the luster of the kickoff of the campaign was removed. I mean, people are not talking about the presser anymore. I was almost considering flipping these topics and putting the Ulyukayev stuff first, because that seems much more important than the message that was sent out of the press conference. Are they just losing their talent for messaging in the Kremlin? Or
yeah, I think it's interesting because the shine of Ukraine, the shine of Crimea, and that boost is waning off.
Yeah,
we don't know what his ideas are, what his program is. He's kind of running out of ideas. He's doing, you know, somersaults and, you know, on one place. You know, he's just he's not moving anywhere. He's trying to preserve the status quo because he thinks that this is safe, but the world moves on. And that's how Russia is left behind, and he's left behind.
Right.
And that's what gives, and the further forward the world moves on, and Russia and its new generation, then the wider the gap, and that's the higher the tension, because when this rope will break, you know, when will it snap?
No, the way I've described it is this is a regime that's run out of stories to tell its people. And I guess on that note, we'll wrap it up because that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been veteran journalist and Kremlin watcher Kirill Suchotsky, executive editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time. Thanks for the enlightening discussion.
Thanks, Brian.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.